Actually, I was just kind of playing for time because I don't want to really talk about this topic very badly. Although when Kate and I were talking about this series of talks of looking at how we can bring our practice into the world, how we engage with the world, some of the things that we want to talk about were the challenges. And I want to talk about despair. I think sometimes when we come to practice, we come with the hope or desire that we will transcend our kind of negative states, our negative emotions. But the bad news is that our afflictive emotions, our kind of bad emotions, the emotions that we don't want, just don't vanish, even though we practice and we study quite diligently. Uncomfortable and painful emotions arise as part of our human condition. And even the celebrated teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh, the famous Vietnamese teacher, these teachers are also subject to afflictive emotions, to the challenging emotions. It is in part because we are human. This is part of what it means to be alive in this world, that we will experience sadness, grief, anger. So bodhisattvas, those beings that have taken up the path, they have ups and downs, or at least this is certainly the case for the average Joe and Jane bodhisattvas like you and me. We come to this practice usually with the intent of somehow mending ourselves, of opening up to some equanimity, some peace. And it is true, with practice, peace and equanimity do arise. But of course, they come and they go. And at times we may feel we're making great progress, you know. Daily life seems more stable, less of an emotional kind of roller coaster, perhaps, that we've been on. But I've noticed, though, that over time, as our hearts kind of open and soften, with this practice, we feel more than ever the pain of living with others in this world. Somewhat perhaps less caught by our kind of self-centered thoughts, our kind of me thoughts. The pain of other people, the pain of others, no longer seems distant or somehow beyond our concern or beneath our notice. So naturally, we offer aid, we give our time, we volunteer at a soup kitchen, or sometimes we just offer an ear. And yet, there are times when what we do or say is of little help, if any. At least it seems that way. My dad used to say, "The world is going to hell in a handbasket." So an intimate relationship may come to an end, despite our best intentions. The efforts we make for the environment or for homelessness, for the rights of an oppressed group, may not result in the change that we so wanted to see. And then added to this is the unending litany of suffering and destruction that we read about in the newspapers or watch on newscasts that leave us often feeling so powerless and desperate in the face of such huge, huge problems. We fall into despair at the impossibility of perhaps fixing the relationship, of fixing the community, of fixing the world. And together with that often arises, of course, a deep critical view of ourselves and others. It all seems so hopeless. You can see why I didn't really want to talk about this. despair is not a word that I use very often. But it's a state I am familiar with, and I think most of us are. The word comes from Latin, a combination of de, D-E, plus sperare, which means hope. So it means to remove hope, or to be removed from hope, despair. And I would describe despair as a kind of constellation of feelings. At least when I look at it, it includes, of course, a sense of helplessness and upset. We want change, but it kind of seems impossible or unlikely to happen. And I think for some people, despair includes sorrow and maybe guilt. Kind of a lot of different things kind of go into this feeling. For me, it's a kind of gray, flat, cold, and painful place, where we are drained of life and we disengage. For this talk, I'd like to suggest that despair and depression are similar but not exactly the same. Not exactly the same. And I'm just suggesting this, I haven't really thought it through carefully, but I think depression is mainly a kind of psychological matter, kind of coming out of one's personal life, while despair, as I'm going to use it, includes the kind of raw confusion and pain that comes from the state of the world. That comes from the state of the world, and whether that's our society, our group of friends, the environment. Joanna Macy, who is a very well-known Buddhist activist, teacher, thinker, philosopher. She calls despair feeling pain for the world. And she writes, "We have to honor and own this pain for the world, recognizing it as a natural response to an unprecedented moment in history. We are part of a huge civilization, intricate in its technology and powerful in its institutions, that is destroying the very basis of life. When have people had this experience before in our history? We ask people to relate to what they experience with respect and compassion for themselves. They are not just griping and grumbling. It is absolutely shattering when we open our eyes and see what we actually are, that we actually are in an accelerating fashion destroying the future." Now she's talking, of course, about the great, particularly environmental issues that we are confronted with. But a few days ago, I asked one of my SFU, I teach at SFU, I asked one of my SFU classes to make a list of hateful things. We had just read an essay written in the late 900s by a Japanese woman who lived in an imperial court in Japan. And the essay was from a book she wrote that includes lists of all kinds. Personal thoughts, interesting events in the court, poetry, and, of course, her sharp opinions of her contemporaries. It's called The Pillow Book by Seishonagon. A really interesting read, by the way. One of those lists that I asked my students to read that she wrote about were about annoyances, or what she calls, or at least what the translator translated as, hateful things. One of the things she found most hateful was an ungraceful lover who leaves in a bumbling way at dawn, for example. I'm sure you all would agree. At any rate, my students had fun with the assignment, but they also took it kind of seriously. One student included in his list people who smell on the bus. And then a few hours after that class, I was on a bus with several people who smelled. And I remembered his comment. I got off the bus at Hastings in Maine to visit a shop where I was headed. And as I walked around, seeing the many street people, the young and older, some sleeping curled up in the alleyways, some sitting on the sidewalk with an empty, you know, coffee cup in front of them for change, I felt despair arise and a kind of urge to turn away from this problem that seemed so big. There was a small voice inside saying, "This feels terrible. Get out of here." Soon after despair arises, I think comes numbing, because despair is so unpleasant, we begin to create kind of diversions for ourselves. In this world with its myriad distractions, countless struggles, and complex global and systematic forms of oppression, where do you give your energy and attention? Do you reach out to help the refugees that continue to search for a place to call home? To home the homeless? To act to slow the rising temperatures on our globe? It seems so overwhelming. Where do we begin? Well, in the Book of Serenity, isn't that a great title? The Book of Serenity. We should all read that. It's a book of collection of Zen stories or dialogues between Zen teachers and their students, sometimes between two Zen teachers. In this book, Case 12, there's a dialogue that I think may help us. I won't give you the whole dialogue, but it is a discussion between Dijong, a Zen teacher who lived in the 800s in China, and a new student who, as the years went on, would become a great teacher as well. So they have this dialogue out in the fields. The new student, Suisheng, comes along. He's coming from South China, visiting the North, and he sees this great Zen teacher, Dijong, hoeing in the fields. And they start this little dialogue saying, "Well, you know, why are you hoeing the fields? Aren't you the great Zen teacher?" And then the Zen teacher says, "Oh, you're from the South, eh?" Implying he's kind of a bit of a country bumpkin. And so the new student kind of fires off a Zen question to him, like, you know, like you're going to zap him or something. And the new student says, "What can you do about the world? What can you do about the world?" What he's asking is kind of, here you are hoeing the turnips. What are you doing about the world? What are you doing about all the suffering in the world? Hoeing turnips. And Dijong, the Zen master, replies, "What do you call the world? What do you call the world?" in this is a clue for us. How can I help a world, a group of people, a relationship that I see as separate from myself, as over there? The problem is over there. Is it something out there that needs saving? What do you call the world? Dizong asks us. I'm not going to tell you the answer. But what is a bodhisattva to do? What are we to do? What makes it possible for us to go through suffering and find meaning in the midst of a catastrophe, or at least a perceived catastrophe? Can despair give rise to inspiration? In those moments of despair, how can we, as everyday kind of Joe and Jane bodhisattvas, respond? What do you call the world? Dizong asks. In our rush to get away, or our rush to fix, we miss an opportunity to see clearly. Perhaps we stop, perhaps if we stop with business as usual, pause in our daily routines, kind of loosen our assumed views, and attend to how things really are, maybe we will come to see what the world is. Because in this, when we pause and are willing to be present in this way, to really see clearly how things are, we acknowledge the outside situation, the poverty, the desperateness of a family, an alienated friend, the environmental degradation perhaps. We acknowledge the outside situation and our internal response. Blame, outrage, fear, grief, whatever it is. And attending to these without judgment, just fully acknowledging as much as possible how things are, we enter into a fertile darkness. Such attending allows compassion to enter. In Buddhism, we call this compassion bodhicitta, the compassion or the compassionate wish to awaken for the benefit of all beings. By gently attending despair in this way, remember the way? See the outside, see the inside, but not judging, not turning away, attending. By attending in this way, our abiding kind of self-centered concerns cracks, perhaps opening us up to new responses, new ways of being and acting in the world. There are many, many examples. I'd like to give you a couple. Not long after the ending of the Khmer Rouge genocide in Cambodia, Maha Gosananda, one of Cambodia's most respected Buddhist monks, decided in 1991 to walk across his country's battlefields with a group of refugees, monks, and nuns to promote peace and reconciliation. Now, who would think of this? Let's just walk. And in walking, make effort to heal this world, this country. And these walks did help to unify the country again. And it also helped to bring international attention to the plight of the Cambodian people. Here's another example. There's a famous Chinese nun known as Cheng Yuan, and she established a foundation known as the Cixi Foundation in an impoverished rural county of Taiwan way back in 1966. Now back then, she was a very simple, devout Buddhist nun, but she was so moved by the misery and pain that she saw around her that she made a very powerful aspiration to relieve the suffering and help the poor. So she joined forces with five female lay people of her temple and 30 housewives, and they decided they would create a charity. And how did they do this? They made baby shoes and sold baby shoes and put the money aside. As long as they had enough for their own food, the rest of it would go in for relieving the poverty they saw around them. And from these very humble origins, Cixi now has 10 million members, active on five continents, something like 90 countries, including Canada. They've done disaster relief in Canada. And they also offer throughout the world medicine, education, cultural events, work for environmental protection, etc. Small impoverished county in Taiwan, now worldwide. And just as important, and more closer to home, several members of Mountain Rain Zen have started a meditation class during the summer at the downtown East Side neighborhood house. Is David here? Oh, did he left? He was one of the people who participated. And the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House is a nonprofit drop-in center that offers food and programs for people of no or very low income. And so they offered meditation that was quite well received. I think how long? 5 weeks, 6 weeks?
So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I mention these not as kind of a goad, like, okay, get out there and do something. Oh, that wouldn't hurt. But just to illustrate that in our times when we feel like we're in some kind of dry, deep well of despair, we can question that story of helplessness that so often arises. The time when we feel completely vulnerable and unable to act in this kind of harsh and hostile world and wonder if there's any point in doing anything at all, is really the best time to practice. Stop and really attend to what's going on inside and outside. Why is it such a good time? Because motivation is so strong. This is awful. Get me out of here, my little voice said. But that's exactly what you shouldn't do. Attend. Look closely. Sit down with some human dignity. Straighten your back. Bring attention to the breath, noticing those troubling thoughts, those dark feelings, but don't get entangled in them. And in doing this over a period of time, we come to see that the thoughts are just thoughts and that the feelings are just feelings. They are not the truth. Just a partial truth for this moment. The Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, that I mentioned earlier, he was asked once, what do we need most to do to save our world? And his answer was this: what we most need to do is to hear within us the sounds of the earth crying. What we most need to do is to hear within us the sounds of the earth crying. Isn't this true? For all the moments when we are overwhelmed with the pain of a relationship, the state of our society, or the earth, we must be willing to first listen deeply. Not to our thoughts, but to the place we find ourselves right now. When we feel despair, it's usually a sign of deep love and deep caring. Sometimes speaking to others about our present dark thoughts and feelings can bring us back to that love and caring. If you're caught in despair, you can be sure you're not alone. Speaking mindfully and honestly to others is a spiritual discipline. Even at work. When we share our inner anguish and fears, we shift our identity. The anger, the fear, the hopelessness is no longer just mine. These feelings, as I said earlier, are just part of what it means to be alive, to be human, to be part of a community. And we may come to see that these strong feelings, the despair, whatever negative feelings you have, connect us to others. Because they too have those same feelings. Suffering isn't something that you have. It's a river that runs through everyone. And that myth of the ragged individual who just kind of blasts his way out, the kind of Marvel superhero that seems to be so popular these days in the movies and TV, is only true in comic books. We need each other. We need to listen to each other. And this alone is empowering. A doorway to recognize our interbeing. And finally, in those moments when we do feel a kind of despair, deliberately bring forward, remember your intention and resolve. We cannot know the outcome of our actions or the outcome of the situation, but renewing our resolve can keep our feet on the path. What is most important for you? What is most important for you? The Bodhisattva path is not one of gaining, but it's one of letting go. And in that letting go, we open up into something that is vast and generous. We discover what we have been given. And naturally, gratitude arises. I thought for a long time, what is the opposite of despair? And of course, my first thing, hope, right? Hope, despair, hope. But I'm not sure hope is the opposite to despair. And I think at the moment, gratitude. And if it's not, it's a really good antidote to despair. This is why everyday practice is so important. It constantly reminds us of our intention, of how we want to live this one and precious life. So I think I'll stop there and I racked my brains thinking, this is our last class, seminar. I don't want to end on despair. I don't want you to get talking about, oh, I was so depressed and despair, this and this. No. I think what I'd like to do is end with the antidote. I'd like us to end with gratitude. And so I'm going to ask you to answer three things. I'll give you some paper just to write down. I'll tell you what they are right now, just so I can then turn this little recorder thing off, and people who are listening to it can do it if they want to. These are the three things I'm going to ask you to write about. We're going to make lists, but it's not going to be hateful things. It's going to be other things. So, things I love about being alive on this earth. Places that were special to me as a child. A person who helped me believe in myself was. And then the fourth one will be, how can I respond to despair?